Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Should we shut the door in the back? Thank you. I'm Courtney Lytle. I am an attorney here in Atlanta. I teach at Emory Law School. I am a corporate lawyer, which is to say I'm a transactional lawyer. I don't do trial stuff. I don't do courtroom stuff. I'm the one who tries to avoid the problems occurring so that we don't have to go to trial. My goal in life when I was in full-time practice at a big firm was to put our litigators out of business. Never happened, but it was my goal. So now I teach intellectual property at Emory, I teach negotiations at Emory, and I still do some practice on the side. And today we're talking about copyright law, which is kind of cool. When I teach this at Emory, it's always fun because as law school classes go, this is one of the more entertaining ones that we do. When you compare this with civil procedure or tax or any of a number of other things, this is really kind of fun. For normal people, it gets fairly dull and dry, but we're lawyers. We have a high threshold for boring and dry before we get upset. And for us, this is great stuff. What we're going to do today is we're going to kind of give you an overview of copyright law, what it protects, what it doesn't, some of the basic parameters of it. And usually, y'all have had a lot of questions in the past when we've done this talk, so I will leave time for y'all to ask me questions. If something is just bugging the daylights out of you as we go through, I can take a question as we go, but probably I will get to what your question is. So unless you're just dying, maybe hold it towards the end, and we will handle as many questions as we possibly can. So, without further ado, copyright law is one-third, basically, of intellectual property. There are three main areas, and I'm going to talk about the other two more to define what copyright isn't than to talk about them in particular. The basic three, the big three for intellectual property, are trademarks, patents, and copyrights. Trademarks are things you see every day. I always have one with me. Look, here's a trademark, Dasani. There's a better recognized red trademark with a white swoosh that is prevalent in this town, except in the Marriott. It's a little weird. They're a Pepsi property. We don't have many of those in Atlanta. But at any rate, the trademark is a company name. It's your logo. It's your slogan. Short little pithy slogans are going to be trademarks. But what the purpose of trademark, although we tend to think it is to help Coke protect their brand name forever and ever, amen, it actually is a consumer protection law. Trademark is intended to protect you guys from knockoff goods. If you buy a can that is red with a white swoosh, you know what you're getting. You're getting a Coca-Cola. And it is made by the Coca-Cola company from a local bottler, and it does not have cocaine in it any longer, although it really did once upon a time. They took that out quite some time ago, sadly for us. But it's stocked full of sugar and caffeine, so two of the basic food groups are covered in that little red can, but you know what you're getting. And that's the whole purpose of it. You know the source of the goods or services that you are consuming. If it says Red Bull, you know it's Red Bull. I still think it shouldn't be called that because it's not red. That has bothered me since the first time I opened one of those cans. I think it's false advertising. No one else agrees. Nevertheless, the can says Red Bull. I've not seen wings. It's not red. Nevertheless, you know what you're getting when you buy it. That's trademark. Trademarks last as long as they are used. They never expire so long as the company continues to use them. So the folks at the Big Red Tower will protect their trademark forever and ever, and it will go on until the end of time. As long as the company's there and using it, they can protect that name. It does not expire. Coca-Cola, I keep bringing up, they and Disney are the two most notoriously strong companies for protecting their trademark. Don't even think about making a con t-shirt with a Coke knockoff. They will find you and they will kill you. They are mean. Same thing with Disney. You'll notice you don't see a lot of Disney character knockoffs. Sometimes people do them because, come on, everyone wants to. But you don't get away with it for long and for very often because the Disney lawyers are fierce also. In the lawyer world, we tend to think the ultimate cage match would actually be Disney trademark lawyers and Coke trademark lawyers. I don't know who would come out, but it'd be a glorious fight. That's trademarks. We're not talking about those today. But that's where your names, your slogans, and like I said, your slogans are one thing that goes there. Because copyright's not going to cover the cute little sayings. You deserve a break today, the good hands people, none of that stuff. All of that is going to be a trademark, not copyright. The next one we're not talking about is patents. One of the reasons we're not talking about it is because today's topic is copyright. The other reason we're not talking about patents is because I don't do patents. That's for the really smart guys. Patents are the science people. Patents are for inventions and processes and machines, those sorts of things. obviously, patent has expanded. You can patent software now. That's a whole different panel also. And business method patents exist. So the idea of making people stand in line could be patented under today's rules. That's stupid. That's another panel also. In order to be a patent lawyer, this is one thing I do always want to warn people, if you do actually invent something that's, you know, physical and does something, has a purpose, solves a problem, accomplishes something real, and you want to patent it, make sure the person you hire is an honest-to-God patent lawyer. Patent lawyers have a separate level of certification. This is almost the only kind of lawyer that actually has a separate certification for their specialty. Most of us just learn stuff and specialize that way, kind of the way y'all do in your careers. Most lawyers are the same thing. I've done big mergers and acquisitions. I started doing some licensing. A professor wanted to take a sabbatical. When I was standing in the hallway, I started teaching copyright. And I became an IP professor and an IP lawyer, you know, in a roundabout way through my career. That's how most fields work. Patent lawyers are different. They sit for a second bar. They take a patent bar. And they have to have a certain background in hard science, a certain number of classes, kind of like a pre-med requirement. So you have to have a hard science background, which is good, because then you'll understand at least some of the science stuff in the patents. The rest of us, yeah, no, we don't have a clue. And we are forbidden to do a number of things, like appear in front of the patent board. Some people will help you file a patent without being an actual patent lawyer. Don't hire them. You want a real, honest-to-God patent lawyer. The way your patent is written and the way it is presented to the patent department will make a huge difference in whether your patent's worth a diddly darn at the end of the day. And they are expensive to get, don't get me wrong. It's going to set you back at least $10,000 to file a patent. But do it right if you're going to do it. Don't use LegalZoom. There's such a thing as a patent agent. They can file things. Some of them sort of know what they're doing, but honestly, I wouldn't recommend it. Find a way to pay for a real patent lawyer and find one that's good, because if your patent's worth filing, it's worth doing right. Don't ask me to do it. Get a patent lawyer. Now, that's patents. Copyright is the rest of it. Copyright is the artsy stuff, the fluffy stuff, the stuff you don't need a technical background to understand, except for software, and we'll get to that too. Copyright is the arts, it's the movies, it's the songs, it's comic books, it's anything you write down, frankly. It is dance performances if they are captured in a tangible medium. Here's the hallmark for copyright. Anything that can be, that is an expression that is captured in a tangible medium is covered by copyright. In the past, when they weren't recording this, my talk in here was not covered by copyright, because you may notice a lack of a prepared speech in front of me. I have not written this down. If I had, that would have been covered by copyright. But they are recording me, and that no longer makes me too nervous, Scott. I'm getting much better at this. So the fact that they are recording me, my speech is being recorded in a tangible medium, even though I'm assuming it's digital rather than real tape or anything, that counts. We're a little loosey-goosey with our definition of tangible. Computers count. This digital recording of me counts. So my speech actually is covered by federal copyright just by virtue of me performing it and them recording it. So once you write down your novel, it is covered. However, you need to go one step further. If you really care about whatever it is you've just produced, if this is not just a doodle that you've done in the corner of your notebook, if this is not a presentation that you are giving at Dragon Con, but which you do not really see a whole lot of future profit generating out of, then just, you know, say, oh goody, I'm protected by copyright, isn't that interesting, move on with your life. If this is something you care about, something you have worked on, this is the collection of photographs you have been taking because you're a photographer, this is the collection of short stories you have written because you are a short story writer, this is the portrait work you have done, whatever it is that you've actually put some time into and care about, file it. Copy it. Go to www.copyright.gov. It's an easy one to find, and it's an easy filing to do. You do not need a lawyer to do this for you. Now, don't get me wrong. Lawyers will take your money and do it for you, but you pretty much go through, you know, from one window to the next. It walks you through it, and you do very little more than giving them your name, the name of your work, a description of what your work is, and $35. That's about it. If you do get confused walking through the screens, if they ask you something and you're not quite sure what they mean, There's a number you can call. The reference attorneys are usually very helpful. Do not ask their advice on how to do it or what you should put. You can ask, because they can't give you legal advice. They won't tell you how to do the right thing for yours. Is it better if I do this or this? They can't tell you that. But what does this mean? How am I supposed to answer this question? That they can tell you, and they're really very good. I didn't say it for trademarks, just in case anyone does want to protect a company name or wants to protect, like, the name of a series of books or their name, or protect your own name as a trademark, also something that people do now. You can probably work your way through the trademark filing. It's more complicated. And a few parts of it you look at and say, what the hell is this? They have a fairly robust FAQ section on the patent trademark site. Patents and trademarks are done from the same department in the government, so it's USPTO.gov, Patent Trademark Office, USPTO.gov. You can file your trademark there. It's a little more confusing. Again, the reference attorneys for the Patent Trademark Office are excellent, as long as you don't ask them how best to do something, because that's what you'd ask your own lawyer. Instead, ask them, what does this mean? Where do I find the options that I could put in here? But there's a lot of information now on the website. It's way better than it used to be. And you could work your way through the trademark thing. You could hire a lawyer to do it, or you could do it yourself. Copyright, don't waste your money on one of us. Patent, yeah, you got to go hire a good one of us. So anyway, we're back in copyrights. File it if you care about your work. It gives you better protection. You have certain rights about going to trial. You have certain evidentiary rights. More importantly, you have evidence of your work and when it was created and that it's yours and that you created it. You also need to send them a copy of your work. If it's, you know, a book, well, that's easy. You send them a digital copy of the work. If it is something like a huge sculpture, on the website it tells you what to do. Generally, they don't actually want you to send the huge sculpture to them. They would prefer you to take a photograph and send them a photograph of your huge sculpture. If you really like to be a little misleading, once you have filed your great novel with them, you send two copies usually. If it's digital, I'm not sure they require that now. But it used to be two physical copies. Now that it's digital, they may copy themselves. They may require two JPEGs. Who knows? But one copy gets filed with the Library of Congress, because this is kind of, and this has always been the case since the dawn of time. That's kind of how the Library of Congress started part of their collection, because everyone had to send them a copy of their book when they wrote them, if they wanted it to be covered by copyright. So everyone had to send a deposit copy to the Library of Congress, and so look, the Library of Congress is a really big collection of books for free. So they still do that, but you can now say with basic accuracy and honesty that your book is that your book is at the Library of Congress. A copy of your book is in the Library of Congress. It's not where anyone could probably get to it. It's not actually on a shelf where you might see it, but it's in the Library of Congress's database somewhere, sort of. Oh, am I too far away?
No.
Okay, so filing, important. Do it. It's easy. It's $35. Now, if you are right, if you're doing pictures, this is a question I commonly get. If you take pictures, you don't have to register every photograph you take, because at $35 a pop, that adds up. At $35 a novel, you're fine. At $35 a photograph, you need a real job. So what you can do is make a collection of your photographs. Gather 100 of them together and make that a book of photographs, a collection of photographs, and file them together. Each one is still protected as part of that entire work. So your work will be your collection of 100 photographs, and all of them are covered at that point. So you don't have to file each individual teeny work. You can if you're made of money. If you're made of money, talk to me after. We can talk.
How large can the collection be?
I don't know that there's a limit. Yeah.
So I saw a lot of photographers out at the con parade this morning, and I'm wondering, those photographs are of people's costumes, perhaps an original character, and are they derivative works, or are they separate?
If you are in a public place, anyone may take your photograph without your permission, and they can pretty much use it any way they like to. There are a few restrictions on that. If you're a famous person, you can't snap a picture of one of the celebrities and then use that photo in a way that says, Richard Dean Anderson likes my blog. Look, here he is. There's a photograph. See, he likes it. Yeah, you can't say that. That's his right of publicity. But unless you're in some way usurping their right of publicity, If you're in a public, I mean, and y'all should just know that. If you're walking around here, this is a public place. Anyone can take your picture, and anyone can post your picture anywhere they bloody well please. There was actually an Atlanta case ages ago where a guy was at a Braves game, and, you know, some photographer snapped a picture of, look, Braves fans, look, they were winning, woohoo. And since it was a game that was like one of the first ones they won ages ago when we sucked, it was, look, the Braves won a game, here's some fans going crazy. And he was actually on the front page of the sports section of the AJC back when people read newspapers. Sadly, he was at a day game, and he had called in sick to attend it. And his boss, being a Southern male, read the sports section every morning and said, oh, look, there's my employee who was too sick to come to work yesterday. So that guy lost his job. And in his spare time, since he was now unemployed, sued the AJC, saying, dude, you didn't ask if you could publish that. And they said, dude, our lawyers are bigger than yours, and we don't have to. So they had both might and right on their side. You have no rights to keep someone from taking your picture if you are in public. And so it's not so much a derivative work or anything like that. You're in public, they can snap you. If you don't want them to see you, don't go out.
Yeah. Yes, what about sites like Flickr or Facebook, collections of photographs that you're constantly adding to?
Mm-hmm.
Would there be any copyright there to keep...
Technically, as soon as it's fixed, meaning as soon as you have taken the picture just about, that's a fixed medium at that point because it's in the memory of your camera now, as soon as it is a photograph, it is technically covered by copyright law. This is important. The law used to be you had no copyright until you filed. And the law also used to be if you published it before you filed the copyright, it was in the public domain, free for use, forever and ever, amen. There was no retrieving it. There are a lot of cases about, oh, well, shit. So maybe I didn't really publish it. So there's a long stream of cases about what published actually means, because people who screwed up and published before they filed said, no, I didn't really publish. I didn't mean it. I take it back. And take it back doesn't work with the government, but maybe it wasn't really publishing. And if you could pay enough lawyers enough money, you convince sometimes a judge that even though you sent it in your newsletter to 25,000 people, it wasn't published. But that doesn't matter anymore. As of the 76 Act, which took effect in 78, we call it the 76 Act, and it took effect January 1, 1978, government action. So the 76 Act changed that. As soon as it is fixed in a tangible medium, it is protected. So everything that you take is technically protected by copyright. But again, if you want to make sure of it, if it's something you really care about that you're going to use commercially that matters, go ahead and take the step to file. But you are protected, even without doing that. So you don't have to update your Flickr account with the Copyright Office. In fact, they'd probably rather you didn't, unless you're like giving them $35. You know, it helps defray their costs. But did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
What if you're taking pictures of people in copyrighted costumes, like the Disney costumes, and you want to make a painting of that?
Well, the Disney costumes wouldn't be copyright costumes. Those are trademarked. If you take a picture of someone, you can take the picture freely. How you use the photo might matter. You could post on your Flickr account. I mean, you can go to Disney and take pictures of Tigger with your kid, and you're allowed to post that. You're allowed to duplicate that copy. But you probably could not use it in a commercial fashion if you are using their trademarked character in a commercial fashion. It's probably when they would come after you.
Even in a big group shot with loads of people and you make a painting of it, which is a different...
That would be a derivative of the photograph, and that's fine. You took a picture of something you were allowed to take a picture of. The derivative work is not of their costume, but is of the photograph you took. The photograph you took was a legal photograph. The derivative is also legal. And so you can take a picture of what you saw in public. That's fine.
If I take a picture, I'm good.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, again, if you're taking pictures of Disney characters, be careful because they're mean. And whether they actually have a good right to come after you or not is not really going to stop them. In law, as many of you have figured out already, sometimes having the right on your side is really irrelevant. If you've got enough lawyers on your side, you can overcome right almost any day. If me and eight of my lawyer friends took on any one of you, we could just outspend you because our legal costs are free because we're just doing it ourselves, and you'd have to hire one of us at $350 or $500 an hour to defend you. So, and again, unless you've got a deep enough pocket to defend a IP suit, even if you're right, it costs you a lot of money to get a judge to say that. And so sometimes, even though the legal answer is, oh, what you're doing is exactly within your rights, The practical answer is don't piss off Disney or Coke because they'll come after you. And if you get a cease and desist letter, you better cease and desist because that generally means they have already hired the lawyers, and if they've hired them to write the letter, they will hire them for the lawsuit. And when you get the cease and desist letter, what I would advise all of you, unless you do have counsel on call and you can afford, you know, thousands of dollars to defend, your answer to the cease and desist letter is, all righty, I've taken it down, I will not use it anymore, sorry. And then don't use it anymore. Okay, one more, then let's get back on track.
Actually, yeah. That's kind of what I wanted to ask you about. I know that there's a trial, going to trial is super expensive, and it can get messy, it's excruciating and torturous, so I know there's a move for ADR, to resolve your issues through ADR.
That's worse.
Is it really?
Yes.
Because I would imagine that filing your copyright, though, would eliminate the need to actually, because, I mean, isn't it cheaper to do things through mediation or arbitration?
No, that's a myth.
Really?
Mediation is actually often a good answer. Mediation is a shorter process, and it's basically just a facilitated negotiation. In many cases, mediation is useful because it's you and the other party and a neutral in the middle to hold a stick and smack people when they get too excited. And they say basically, no, come on, we got to come to a good solution here. And the mediator, if she's a good mediator, there's some really bad mediators. A lot of law students who couldn't get jobs say, I'm a mediator now. If you ever need a mediator, find one from an established mediation group. Pay the money for a good one because a bad mediator is worse than no mediator at all. A good mediator is a fabulous tool to solving a dispute that doesn't need to go to trial. If both parties are willing to be reasonable and come to a solution, in mediation, the solution is mutual. Both sides have to agree. It's basically someone sitting down and playing mom and saying, okay, Jimmy, you apologize. Okay, say it's all right, now give him back his toy. Yeah. And so that's what the mediator basically does, is sit them down and make them behave and get them to a solution. And that can still be expensive because you're paying probably both your attorney and the mediator, and no one works for less than $400 an hour. So it's still an expensive process, but it probably will be finished in a reasonable time, and you're not going to be stuck with a bad result because you have to agree. Arbitration is a crock. Never go with that.
Huh.
I think that it should be such a grievous term that it actually vitiates commercial contracts. It doesn't. It should be, but it doesn't. Arbitration is basically like trial, but none of your rights are protected. It will take just as long, it will be just as expensive, but the outcome is even more random because a lot of the protections you have at trial are not in arbitration. People tell you it's a great thing, it's a great alternative to trial, they're lying. Mediation can be useful. Arbitration's a crock. You're better off in a courtroom. Oh, yeah. If you have filed the copyright, you have a stronger right in whatever you've created. But if what you created is an infringement of someone else's work, it doesn't help you a bit. The Copyright Office does not review what you have filed. So the fact that you have filed it does not mean that your work has somehow been blessed by the Copyright Office. It just means we got it, your check cleared, you're in. It does not mean that your work is not infringing someone else's work. It does not mean your work is actually even original enough to be a copyrighted work. It just means that you filed it and they took your money. You won't know if it's a truly valid copyright until a judge tells you. The presumption is that it's valid, but if someone wants to challenge it, look, there you are, back at trial. Let me get through a little bit more of what I wanted to say before we go to the rest of the questions, because we started with file your copyright. We haven't gotten any further. So let me do a little bit more of the substance before we go into each of the questions.
Okay.
So we stopped with file your copyright. So file your copyright. Now, a little bit about what copyright does and doesn't cover. The standard for copyright is that it has to be an original work. Well, original in copyright is a very, very low standard. It doesn't have to be clever. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be really novel or original in that fashion. In fact, if I were on a desert island, and while I was there, I had a lot of paper, and I wrote a little book about a boy in England who lives with his annoying, non-magical friends, talks to snakes, ends up going to a school with wizards, has a lightning bolt on his head, you know, something like that. If I were to write a really thick children's novel along those lines, if I wrote it myself, I was on a desert island, I have not been exposed to anything that's happening in the rest of the world for the past, 20 years, whenever she wrote the thing, If I wrote that same novel, word for word, what she wrote, I could still copyright mine, and I would not be violating her copyright, because I independently created my Harry Potter. I called him Larry Potter as a quirk, and it just so happens that's the only difference between my work and hers, is my kid was named Larry. Well, I independently created it. Now, you would have to pretty much be able to prove you were on the island the whole time, otherwise no one would believe that you independently created it. But assuming that we know in our hearts, I wrote that book all by myself, it is just as valid a work as hers is. What I cannot do is copy someone else's into my work. And copy is more than just a verbatim copy. Obviously, I can't take her name off the cover of the book, smack mine on, and sell it. Well, duh. But I also couldn't write a book about Larry Potter, a kid who lived in Ireland, and who, change a little step of the story all the way. His best friend didn't have red hair, he had black hair, and he, didn't have two twin older brothers, he had two twin younger sisters. Yep. Obviously, I'm knocking that book off. And I'm not allowed to do that either. All that is copywritten is her expression of her idea. And it seems like that's an obvious thing. Her idea of the well-developed Harry Potter universe and the story and the characters is something I can't knock off. But where is it her idea is not protected. Her expression of the idea, the words she uses to tell that story, those are protected. The basic idea is not. Copyright does not protect the substance of what you write. If you write a book that is a factual book, if you write a history of the state of Georgia, anyone is free to take any facts from that book, even crap you make up. If you put it out as a fact, people are allowed to take that. Conspiracy theory books, every now and again one of them is knocked off for either another conspiracy theory or for a play or something, and that's fair to do because the conspiracy theory nuts always say, this is true. Well, that means you're presenting it as a fact, and if it's a fact, it's not protected. Copyright does not protect facts, it does not protect ideas, it does not protect processes. So if you are describing in your book how to turn lead into gold, anyone is free to use your method of turning lead into gold. Anyone is free to take your directions, put them in another book, and make a ton of money selling how to turn lead into gold, as long as they don't use your words and your expression. But when there's only one or few ways to express something, like take a lump of lead, put it in the bathtub, cover it in cat hair, leave it for 3 years, it will be gold when you're done. There's only a few ways to describe that simple process. I'm not endorsing this process. But there's only a few ways to describe that. So you don't have any copyright in your very basic description of what's done. Recipes, for instance, cannot be covered by copyright. A cookbook can, but what's protected there is the selection of recipes, the arrangement of the recipes, and perhaps the way they're laid out and any photographs and stuff like that. So you couldn't completely knock off that cookbook, but you can take recipes out of a cookbook and put them in a different cookbook and sell it. Just make sure that you aren't literally photocopying it and sticking it in your book. But you can use the recipes themselves. Now, you can't use all the same recipes in the same chapters because then you're knocking off the protected arrangement and selection. But you can use the actual recipes. You can use that form of turning lead into gold if you like. And if you write that book, that would be one of those that if that cat hair thing works, you probably should call a patent lawyer first because that would be a process you would like to protect. And that would be something you would patent. The process of turning lead into gold, if you have patented it, no one else can use that process without your permission or without writing you a really nice big check. I would recommend not licensing that because once gold is freely available, the value of it will plummet. So I would instead just do it yourself and get rich. But that's my investment advice for the week. But that process to preclude others from using it, you would patent it. If you describe it in a book, anyone can use it. They just can't copy how you describe it to the extent your description extends beyond just a how-to. Does that make sense? Okay, so your facts are not covered, directions are not covered, the substance is not covered. But when we get back to Harry Potter, the idea of any copyright is also not covered. Well, that's where it gets a little squishy. In concept, okay, sure, the idea of young boy wizard school is not going to be protectable. Well, a good thing, because there's at least 8,000 other of those books out there before and since. Somewhere between Young Wizard Goes to School and the full fleshed out detailed version of Harry Potter is a line that you can't cross. I don't know where that line is. It is kind of murky. Usually when you get too far past it, you know better. If it starts being identifiably Harry Potter, then you can't go there. If it's just the basic literary formula, young boy is orphan, doesn't know his own powers, comes into some either magical power or unknown kingship, matures, saves the world. Well, I've read 1,000 of those. You all have two. And those aren't derivative of each other. It's that one, the basic idea, that basic plot line is too basic to be protected, and it's already in the public domain, so it's been written 1,000 times before. So you can't protect that basic thing. Now, it's always a little interesting, though, because you also have the issue of, well, compared to what? My mother is not a science fiction or fantasy fan. In fact, she has been exposed to exactly two things that would ever be here at DragonCon, well, aside from the science stuff, she's a physicist. She saw Star Wars, like the real one, the first one, in the, well, I know this is the fourth one, but the good one, in the movie theater. In the movie theater. And one time when she was at my house and was sick and ran out of the books she brought, she took Harry Potter off the shelf and read it. She finished the book and said, well, that's a piece of crap. That's a direct knockoff of Star Wars. I'm like, huh? And she's like, yeah. It's this little kid who doesn't know that he's got these powers, who doesn't know who his parents were, is raised by, you know, uncles and aunts or whatever it was, slowly discovers he has these magic powers. Shoot, the bad guy even has a similar name, Vader and Voldemort. I mean, come on. And I'm like, holy cow, when you strip it down that far, yeah, they are kind of similar, but to me they don't seem similar, because that basic story of kid doesn't know who his parents are, grows up vaguely frustrated, unhappy, discovers, I can save the universe, yay! I mean, that's a real popular book. We all like that plot. So we've read it a lot, so people have written it a lot. And it's like, well, no, it doesn't really knock off Star Wars, that's just taken from a real standard, you know, almost as common with us as, you know, girl meets boy, things go badly, book, which is the rest of the books. So, you know, boy meets girl, things go badly is not protected. At some point, you get far enough down that road that you've written Romeo and Juliet, and that would be protected. Shakespeare could have filed a copyright if he was alive when they had those things. Right now, Romeo and Juliet's not covered. It's in the public domain. West Side Story, I don't know if it still has a copyright, probably so. So you can't take the Romeo and Juliet characters and put them dancing in gangs right now. That's still covered, but that idea, boy meets girl, things go badly, is not protected. Okay, so your ideas aren't protected, the facts that you write aren't protected, that's an important one. And if there's only one or few ways to describe something, like a list, apply shampoo, lather, rinse, repeat, no one owns that. Because copyright, they try very hard to make sure that no one gets to own any words. In trademark, you might get to own a word, but you don't get to own a word that describes your product. Coke lost the word cola from their name. When they made cola up, it was actually a made-up term. But cola became used for that particular flavor of fizzy soda, and now the word cola describes that drink, so Coke doesn't own cola anymore. They own it. They own the script they wrote it in, but they don't own cola. So they're really neurotic about protecting Coke, because they already lost half their name. So you don't get to own words that other people might want to use. You don't get to own colors unless it's kind of random. Owens Corning owns pink for their aluminum, for their fiberfill stuff, because that stuff normally comes out in a kind of ugly gray thing. There's no reason in the world for it to be pink. Pink identifies that it's their product. If they had picked a color that would be normal or would have some reason to be an insulation, they wouldn't have been allowed to use it as an identifying characteristic. We try very hard in all of IP to make sure that we're giving the authors or the inventors enough protection to give them incentive. And that's what the whole reason we have the IP law is. The government is giving you incentive to create, because it's better for society if people are out there inventing and writing and painting and singing and dancing. Sing and dance in the streets, it's fun. But they say, but as of the, I mean, it's in the Constitution. This was set forth as one of the basic parts of our Constitution. We want to encourage that kind of creativity. And in order to do that, we're smart founding fathers. We know that what actually encourages people to be able to do that is the ability to feed their children while they're doing it. So we will, as a government, give you an enforceable monopoly over this artwork, this story, this invention, and we will help you enforce that monopoly so you make money for a limited amount of time, and then when we say, okay, long enough, anyone can use it, and the world is better off because more stuff has been created. Part of it from a historical standpoint is also because they realized that since we're kind of doing away with the aristocracy and the church isn't running the country, we've run out of a lot of places where people could be get their patrons to pay for their paintings and their artistic life. We're kind of smack out of patrons, so we have a monopoly instead. But it's a limited monopoly, and it's limited by time. Patents are usually good for 20 years. Remember, I said trademarks go forever. Patents are about 20 years, and there's exceptions. Copyright currently lasts for the life of the author plus 70 years. So 70 years after your death, your copyright expires. Used to be a fixed number of years. There were two terms. If you didn't file for renewal, it expired. And then the second term kept getting stretched a little further and further as we changed the copyright law. But the current term, if you write something now, it's good as long as you're alive and 70 years after you're dead. If it's owned by a corporation, the rules are a little different because corporations never die, but it's basically 95 years from publication. So your copyright will eventually expire, but it's given to you for a long enough term that you and your heirs will benefit from your work. And that's how the government thinks you'll be incentivized to create for the good of the world. Okay, we probably should break. Okay, you had a question. Oh, wait, I didn't do fair use. Let me do fair use real quick. Fair use is something everyone wants to talk about as a general rule. I knew there was something I hadn't gotten to. Fair use. Okay, most of y'all are familiar with fair use. Fair use is the, oh, but I want to just use part of that book and talk about it. I want to write the next, I want to write some Star Trek fan fiction. I want to write about what Kirk and Spock were really doing in between these two movies. I want to write about something like this. And I'm not original enough to make up my own stuff, so I want to use someone else's. Well, that's a derivative work, and that's protected by copyright, and you can't do it unless you have permission. Unless it's covered by fair use. Don't rely on fair use. There are a lot of cases out there telling you what fair use is, and there's a lot of crap out on the internet telling you, oh, this use is fair, you're allowed to do it. Go ahead, it's fair use, it's criticism, it's parody, you can do this for free. No, don't believe that crap. You're going to get sued and you're going to lose. Fair use is a defense against an infringement action. Fair use is irrelevant until you are sued and you respond to their suit. Responding to their suit requires one of me. So fair use is going to cost you thousands of dollars. This is probably not what you want to use. If you fly beneath the radar and you never get caught, go ahead, infringe your heart out. But don't fool yourself into thinking you have some God-given right to do so. A lot of copyrights aren't enforced. A lot of studios and stuff encourage fan fiction because they're smart enough to realize if we're all jazzed up enough about their product to write our own stuff about their product, it's keeping us all really excited. We pay money to see the old stars here. Whatever crap they put on a screen, we will go buy tickets and see it. And that makes them happy. So most of the big studios now actually let you write about whatever fan fiction you want to. If you start selling it and making money doing it, then they may come knocking on your door. But if you want to write a piece of fan fiction and post it on your blog, you're probably never going to get any trouble for it. But don't fool yourself into thinking you have some right to do so. Copyright keeps you from doing that unless you have a really good lawyer. I know one downtown who can convince a judge that anything is fair use. He is responsible for some of the absolute worst decisions in the history of copyright law, and he's absolutely brilliant at doing it. So if you are accused of infringement, holler at me. I will set you up with Joe Beck. Now, you better have a big checkbook because he's really good at what he does, but he can convince a judge that any old piece of crap is fair use. So that's where the answer to fair use comes in. Fair use is supposed to be if I'm writing a book review, I can quote a little bit of the book in my book review. If I am teaching a class, which I commonly do, and I want to use a portion of a, if I want to show a picture of a painting, if I'm teaching an art class, which would be hysterical because I don't know anything about art, but if I wanted to, you know, show a slide of a painting, I can do that because it's in a classroom. It's for educational purposes. Those sorts of things are protected by fair use. There was just a new Georgia case, in fact, on fair use in an academic setting, which was 350 pages long. Feel free to read it. But at the end of the day, it tells us that as academics, if we want to use up to 10% of someone's published work in our classroom, we can do so. That isn't exactly what the judge really said. She had a much more finessed answer to the question. It's an excellent opinion, which I don't say about a lot of things. And she actually had a fairly finessed opinion to how it should be calculated out. And, of course, everyone in the state has distilled 350 pages into 10% or less. Go. It's already on the walls of every copy center and every university in the country. It's astounding. Oh, what is it? It's Georgia State. Who sued Georgia State? I think everyone sued Georgia State. Oxford and Cambridge v. Georgia State. Just if you Google Arenda Evans and fair use, you'll get it. Not really. Fair use can also be parody. Saturday Night Live parodies movies all the time. So they get away with it because that's an actual parody. Parody has been stretched to cover really bad literature, like The Wind's Done Gone. That was somehow a parody of Star Wars. That would be interesting. Gone with the Wind. That's one of Joe Beck's pieces of handiwork. I'm like, a parody? Really? How'd you do that? That judge is usually really smart, too. Damn, you're good. So there are things that you can do beyond just that, but it's criticism, parody, educational, and research are kind of the big places. But they say that, and yet some researchers at Texaco had been making copies of National Geographic articles. You know, their office had one subscription that went around on a read rotation, and they would copy the articles that they wanted to use for their own research, which is smack dab in the middle of approved by the statute, until the magazine got wind of it and sued them, and they lost. Which what they were doing seemed flat in the middle of allowed. Copies for classroom use is expressly allowed under the fair use statute, and yet a professor who had a packet of things copied for classroom use lost and was found to be infringing. And that's not the recent one. It was back before you could get things easily. One thing that has changed is since most publishing is now very centralized, it's really easy to get licenses to use pretty much anything you want to. It's all just a matter of pro forma. In the textbook I just published, I actually had a long article that is on fair use by Judge Laval from the Second Circuit, written 20 years ago, saying, gosh, I hope this gets better because it really sucks right now. None of us know what it means. And he's one of the smartest judges we have. And he's like, God, I have no clue. This is a mess. And he's like, but I'm pretty sure that we'll all pull together and come up with some good law soon. That was 20 years ago. It's gotten worse. But I was using that article, and I have always copied it and given it to my students. Well, it was a little bit embarrassing that Courtney, the big copyright lawyer, was writing this textbook, and it's stuff that I use in my class. And so I had that article in my chapter. And my editor very correctly said, well, do you have permission to use that? Because it's a fairly long excerpt. I'm like, well, no, it's educational. He's like, dude, we're selling the book. I'm like, someone might buy my book. Oh, my God, that'd be so cool. But, yeah, this is technically commercial use. Oh, holy cow, we got to get permission for all this crap. So I spent the next couple days calling up. There's a Copyright Clearance Center. They own pretty much everything that's academic. And you just go and say, hey, I want to use this section of this work. And like I said, this Leventhal article is 20 years old. I didn't have to track him down. I didn't have to track down the editors of the University of Pennsylvania Law Review that had published it. I called Copyright Clearance Center and said, I want to use that article. They said, okay, give me $30. I said, okay, and we were done. Lawrence Lessig, a big Creative Commons copy left kind of guy, I have a real extensive excerpt from him because law students don't usually hear about his weird anarchy stuff. And he's all about free use, free sharing. I'm like, well, technically he has it under a Creative Commons license and it says free for non-commercial use. Well, shit, I'm commercial now. And so I wrote him an email saying, hey, can I use most of your chapter and put it in my book? Thinking, shit. And I was like, please say no, because it'd be so cool for me to be able to have a little paragraph in my book about how you say you're all in favor of sharing information, but ha ha ha, you weren't. Damned if he didn't respond to me within like 10 hours and say, sure, please feel free to use it. If you need anything else, just give me a call. I'm like, wow. So you're not a jerk and you're not a hypocrite. Well, that's not as good a story. But his excerpt is in my book. So, but the short answer is get permission if you want to use something, because chances are you can get it. And that way, you won't get in trouble. All of us learned in high school, it's easier to be forgiven than to get permission. That does not hold true in a trial. Get permission first. Okay, we've done fair use, we've done what copyright is, we've done what it isn't, we've done how long it lasts. Let's do questions.
Okay, so you said that in an educational setting there's a clearance center that you could contact for
yes.
people who you cannot find personally, perhaps. What
about chances are you need to use the Copyright Clearance Center anyway. Oh. Most things that are published academically, unless it's a really big dog of a professor, they don't own the copyright anymore. Whoever published it gets the copyright to their work.
Well, I think a lot of people here are probably writing something in a fandom.
Mm-hmm.
For example, role-playing games are a classic start for a series. So if you have a role-playing setting that you use or a rule set, and you cannot find the people who created it, what do you do? I mean,
use
way?
Something else.
Okay.
If you're starting one of your own, however, this is something that I was making fun of Lawrence Lessig there for a minute, but I do want to turn you all on to the Creative Commons, creativecommons.org. A lot of people use these licenses. A lot of people in the science fiction and fantasy industries are using these very commonly because it gives you a different set of rights than the standard copyright. Standard copyright is no one can use my shit unless I say so. Period. That's it. You can't use my stuff unless I say you can. The Creative Commons licenses give you a much broader ability to say, okay, look, if you want to use my stuff to write a derivative work, if you want to write an extra adventure for my game, if you want to draw pictures of my characters, go nuts. Go ahead. We encourage it as long as it's not commercial, or even if it is commercial. You can set, there's different versions of the Creative Commons license. A very common one that people put their stuff out under is free for non-commercial use. And that's how Lessig's stuff is generally released. So when mine became commercial, I had to ask him. But a lot of games and things like that are released under a Creative Commons license. So check the work. It may be, as long as you're not using the work commercially, you're free to use it. And if you're creating something, look at the Creative Commons license. The general rule is I would tell you anything you find on the internet that pretends to be legal advice is crap. Don't use it. The exception is the Creative Commons license. It's very, very good. It's user-friendly. There's little descriptions at the beginning of each contract telling you what the contract means, and it's accurate. They have actual human-friendly descriptions of what's in the contract. You don't have to have a law degree to understand it. And the captions that people use when they have the Creative Commons licenses are at the bottom of their work, and it tells you very clearly what you can and cannot do with their work if you want to use pieces of it or be inspired by it or write an adventure in their world or something like that. So look for the Creative Commons because the game you're thinking of may have been released under it and it may be fine for you to use even if you can't find the people. They may have said, yeah, go nuts, because they want it to be shared. I mean, that's something in our community that's very prevalent is we want to share stuff. We don't want to keep anyone from ever seeing our things. We want everyone to look at it and to use it and to expand it and enjoy it. And the Creative Commons license is a great way to accomplish that without completely giving all of your rights away. So look for that, because it may be how it's released. Yeah?
I had a question. I heard someone told me that if an author acknowledges there's fan fiction of their work, then they lose their copyright.
Yeah.
Because they would have to, if they knew about the fan fiction, they would have to pursue
there
it legally.
There is a point after which they will have been deemed to have sat on their rights and failed to enforce, but just because I'm aware of an infringer, I don't automatically lose my right to stop them.
Well, what's the point then? The point where of like no return or whatever?
Well beyond anything reasonable.
Well beyond any. Okay, thank you.
Rowling is one who lets kids write some fan fiction, and remember she shut down the kid who did the encyclopedia. Again, very reasonable. She says, oh, if you're writing cute little stories or kids are drawing all the pictures, yeah, go nuts, enjoy my work, keep going. No, wait, I might write one of those. Knock it off.
Yeah.
And so that's when she told him to stop. She wasn't worried that something an 8-year-old wrote was going to usurp her market. So she let them do that freely, but when the kid actually put together enough stuff, she's thinking, oh, no, see, that's something we may publish and make an extra couple million dollars as a hobby. No. And so she shut him down at that point. So the fact that people have been writing stuff for ages didn't matter. I think that boy had, in fact, put up a fairly substantial fan site that she allowed, and everything he was doing was fine, up to the point he crossed that line, and he got shut down. So don't assume that there's some point beyond which. That's more of a real property standard. If you know someone's living on your property and you don't kick them off, then they actually do get adverse possession rights. That's more of a real property concept than intellectual property. It may every now and again bleed over, but I would not rely on it. Yeah.
We've talked about how copyright is a shield, but also I guess a lot of us are interested in how it's more of a sword. Like from my understanding, if I don't, if I have copyright, so if I don't register my photos, like I do event photography, that if someone copies it, prints it, whatever, then I only get actual damages. So if I charge $5 for the photo, I can basically only go after them for $5. But if the idea of registering is for statutory damages, mm-hmm. What we hear about the $150,000 or whatever. I do event photography, but mm-hmm. also I can't register $35 for every event. If I do
right.
two or three a week. Is it true that a copyright, I can publish it, or I can copyright it within 90 days of publishing it? So if I put it on Facebook on my website, that's publishing it. So as long as I register the copyright within 90 days, I get the statutory protection.
Yeah, they've added the 90-day limit fairly recently. And again, publishing is an ill-defined thing as well. How broadly your Facebook, I mean, if it's open for public viewing, that probably is publication.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of current case law on publication because it doesn't matter for the most part anymore. The 90-day thing is fairly new, and it hasn't really worked its way through the courts much yet. I mean, if this is your profession and you want to protect it, I mean, first off, find ways to make your stuff protected, put your little name on it and things like that. You know, watermark it, whatever else you can come up with. To a certain extent, make sure that if it goes out, your name's on it, if nothing else. And yes, you can absolutely copyright it and you can go after them. Chances are you're not going to be able, if you're worried about a $35 filing fee, you're not going to be able to afford to enforce your copyright. So you need to be creative in how you market and how you get people to see it so that they're less inclined to steal. And if they do steal, at least you're getting free publicity because your name is right across the middle of it.
Or if you go pro se, but that's,
yeah,
going
that's
through them
not going to work very well. It can happen. You know, you can, I represented myself pro se once, but that was kind of different. I would register. If you, every month, pay another $35 and register everything you've taken that month. Just make that part of your routine, I'm sure.
Or every 90 days possible. Like, I went to Africa, got 20,000 pictures and probably 1,500 this weekend, so I can register all within, if it's all within 90
yeah.
days.
If I were you, what I recommend to photographers usually is just, you have a, I mean, I'm sure you already have a process that you are very good about, taking pictures and going home and automatically backing up and downloading all of your pictures. Just, you have that process that you do religiously. Add to that process every 30 days, every 60 days would be safe. I wouldn't go 90 because you'll screw up once and it'll all be over. I would go 30 or 60 days, depending on how much you're doing, and just at the end of every month, file everything you've done that month. $35 a month isn't that much. If that is more than you're comfortable with, we'll do it every 60 days. I wouldn't go every 90 because if you miss it by a day, you know, that'll be the one that you miss by a day will be the one that matters. That's just how it works. Murphy's Law is a very one is when you can rely.
Is the 90 days based on the postmark or date received?
I don't know. That's one thing. Some of you have heard that the poor man's copyright is to mail it to yourself. No. I don't know where that came from. I put it in my mind as something that they taught me in first aid. I was 15 taking a first aid case course, and they told us not to put butter on burns. I thought it was weird because they didn't mention any other condiments, but apparently there's an old wives' tale that putting butter on a burn will help it. It doesn't. It just makes it gross and greasy and usually infected. So if any of you have heard put butter on a burn, that's really stupid. And putting your work in an envelope and mailing it to yourself is also really stupid. It has absolutely no value whatsoever.
I think that came from the patent case with Alexander Graham Bell. And when he was fighting the patent, he had to prove that he got his work out before this other guy that was contesting it.
Right.
And he had taken one of his lab notes and wrote a letter to his wife on the back. And they were able to use that to prove that he got it before the other guy and he got his patent. But it has nothing to do with copyright.
Right. And doesn't work in patent anymore either.
Okay. A recent bestseller is allegedly the result of fan fiction. And if you write fan fiction and you decide that your new 60 Shades of Red is truly lovely, how far do you have to go to file the serial numbers off for it to be an original work? What's a safe harbor for that?
There is no such thing as a safe harbor. If your work is derivative of someone else's, you can assume that it's a derivative work. And the difference between a derivative work, which is protected, the new stuff you add is protected. The stuff from the original work is not protected. The new stuff you add is protected. But the difference between an original work, between a derivative work and an infringing work is permission. If you have written an unauthorized piece of fan fiction, it is an infringement of the original work and you have no rights to it. You have no copyright in an infringing work. If your work is a piece of fan fiction without permission, you have no protection in it. Is that what you were getting at?
I was getting more in terms of how much you have to change something to make it original.
It has not be, it can't look like or smell like or sound like the original. If I read yours and say, oh, this is a knockoff of that book that everyone's reading and thinks is good, well, then it's a derivative. If I read and go, oh, this is clever, how original, then it's original. There's no hard line, unfortunately. There's no answer of at least six names must be different and the chapters have to be numbered oddly. There's no way to quantify what's different enough. That's why I was talking about that spectrum. Somewhere between boy meets girl, things go badly, and Romeo and Juliet is the line you can't cross. Where is that line? Oh, hell, I don't know. You usually don't know for sure until a judge tells you. The more obviously original you can make it, the better. The more safe you'll be. But if it looks like a knockoff, it's probably a knockoff. That's kind of that duck quacking thing. Yeah.
Okay, if I'm working on a novel and I decide to put some snippets, you know, some chapters of that novel, or do some short stories and put it on my website, mm-hmm. will that make it more difficult to publish later on? This is if I go ahead and, you know, do that basic copyright, will this make it more difficult to publish later on, or will they come out with a more professional copyright?
There's only one kind of copyright, professional okay. or otherwise. If mm-hmm. you have filed your work and it's covered by copyright, it's as protected as it can be. And if you put pieces of it on your website, it's advertisement. If you've put it out for free and self-published it, usually commercial publishers won't touch it anymore. Now, commercial publishers are now putting their stuff out for free online sometimes. I mean, Bain does a lot of free work. But if you're a startup person and you're hoping to get that first writing contract, you're better off taking those short stories and getting them published in an actual anthology. Or you know, submitting them to some of the contests that are out and getting them published somehow to say, look, I got published by someone else. Now, self-publishing is becoming more credible. It's still not the same as being published. And the commercial publishers, the ones who pay you, if you are paying someone to publish you, you are not a published writer. You are a sucker. That's Vanity Press. That's fine if you just want some hard copies of your book that look pretty. That's great, but that's why it's called Vanity Press. I want my name on a binder of a professional-looking book. That's what they'll do for you. It does not make you a published author. So if you want to have, if you want to groom yourself to be attractive to agents and to commercial publishing houses, the most successful route still tends to be write a bunch of short stories, start submitting them, because they're faster than a novel. You know, you can't write a bunch of novels and start submitting them. Plus, there are a lot of places that still publish, you know, magazines that have anthologies in them, and some of them are online now, but the ones that are real. You know, Analog used to publish all that stuff. I don't know who still does those things, but find those, find the contests, and find ways to get your short stories published. That gets you published, and that makes you look like you have a track record to the publishers. Look, I publish my own stuff they don't care about. And like I said, a lot of publishers, if you have published your entire work for free, they're not going to pay to publish your work. Because, you know, the competing free stuff's already out there. And so they just usually won't. Not from anything legal, just from a, how are we going to make money on that? You already gave it away. There are exceptions. Some people have built up a fan base with their free work. And that's, a lot of music contracts are happening that way, too. Instead of having to go on concert tours until someone picks you up for a contract, a lot of it has to do with how many likes are on your damn Facebook page. So sometimes, by publishing your stuff online, you can demonstrate to a publisher that you have already an established fan base. That sounds like money, and they might pick you up, but they probably won't publish something you've already given away to this fan base. They'll want you to come up with something new that your fan base might now buy, and they already know the difference between what people are willing to read for free and what people are willing to pay for. Okay. We can go a little longer. We're at 11:30. Can we go a bit more?
Yeah.
I mean, it's 12:30.
Yeah, we can go 10 minutes.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to use somebody as another example, but I do some stuff like it. So I've seen a gentleman online dressed up in a Legend of Zelda character outfit. He is using the original, like, sample of the music, but then he changes it and he starts rapping, and he has it on a YouTube video, and he's selling the song on iTunes. Is that video that he put on YouTube copyrighted? Is the dance he's doing copyrighted? And is that, like, the parody song he's doing, is that copyrighted?
Presumptively, the people who own that music could shut him down if they were so inclined. Mm-hmm. They either haven't noticed him or don't care.
Oh, okay.
But he is infringing the music because he has made an unauthorized derivative work of their, presumably protected and owned by someone, music from Zelda. The rest of what he's doing, if mm-hmm. his costume is a representation of a protected character from Zelda, he didn't own that either, and he could be shut down for that, as well as for the music. To the extent he has created an original dance or an original work, well, it's a little bit fudgy because it's a derivative work, but the dance is something one assumes is not anywhere in the original product. Mm-hmm. Is there anything like it in the original product?
No.
Okay. As long as he's not doing just a slightly different dance than the one his character does on the screen, that would be okay. So as long as that part's really original, maybe he would have a right to the choreography of that dance. The expression he's shown on YouTube, probably not, since it's infringing on some levels. But there probably is something in there that he could make a reasonable claim to owning. Like I said, it's a little bit cagey because what he's doing is tied up with two pieces of infringement, both the costume and the music. Now, it's infringement, but no one cares right now. But, you know, we're talking about how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin to a certain extent. It is an infringement, so his derivative work is not protectable. But I might be able to make an argument that the original dance he is doing itself would be original, but in itself, not in relation to Zelda. Anything done with Zelda is a knockoff and is unauthorized.
Okay, but what about, say, Weird Al? I mean, his is
direct parody, and he always gets permission.
Okay.
Everything he does, he gets permission for, because he's not an idiot. And he has been denied. Most people say, cool, go ahead, because his stuff is usually kind of funny and not usually mean to the people he's parodying. He arguably would be able to, I mean, he is kind of poster child for parody, but he gets permission.
In fact, there's a case where he got permission, did the video, and the guy changed his mind and didn't publish it.
He always makes a point of not pissing off the people he's making fun of, and that's why he has stayed out of court, and that's why he has money as opposed to trials. Yes.
You mentioned about you can take a collection of photos
mm-hmm.
and copyright $35 fee. Can the same be said for songs?
Sure.
Okay, cool. I've got a whole, not that they're any good, but lifetime of songs I could.
Yeah, you can.
Instead of $35 a song, so
yeah.
Cool.
You can do it all in one fell swoop.
You could do a collection of the songs, send them in as a collection rather than individual.
Yeah.
So my question is about artistic styling. So if you have an artistic style, hard lines, that sort of thing, and you do, say, and this is a poor example because I know that something like this exists with the copyright holder, but if you did something where you did a different style of art for a character, like instead of using hard lines, you do stucco painting or something like that of the same sort of character.
You've lost me. Who's the original work? And
well, I'm getting there.
Works?
We're getting there.
Okay.
We're talking about changing the style of the work.
Of what work?
So that you have basically
an existing work?
Hold on. We're getting there. If we're using, say, DC characters. So this is very obviously a child Batman who looks nothing like the hard line drawing of a Batman.
Style's not going to save you. That's a knockoff.
Right. And there's no.
Let's talk about this one after. I think this is going to take a few minutes. Let's do this afterwards so we can get some more questions in.
Okay.
We're coming up against a deadline here. But I can talk to you afterwards about that one.
Okay. Hopefully, that'll be quick. When do things fall into the public domain? Because I can't really figure that out. Like, the example I'm thinking of is The Great Gatsby, written by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald died December 1941. And I thought copyright law was,
this was
70 years after death of the creator.
The 70 years after death is the new rule. His work was written, what do you remember the year of publication?
Probably in the 30s.
In the 30s, it would still be covered if he filed for the renewal. There's 1922, I think, is the magic date. The original copyright, or the Copyright Act prior to 1978, the 76 Act, is the 09 Act. So anything published after 1909 and before 1978 was covered by, there's two terms of copyright. After the first term, you had to renew. If you didn't renew, you fell into public domain then. If you did renew, you got the extended term, and the second term was then extended several times by the 76 Act. And the way that the math works out, somewhere, I think it's 1922, but don't quote me on that, is the cutoff date. Anything before 1922 is in the public domain. anything after 1922 could be protected if they filed for the renewal period. And chances are that novel was filed for renewal period, so if it were published in the 30s, it would still be covered.
Okay.
My question is with poems and illustrations. I know illustrations would fall under trademarks, but
an illustration is artwork.
Okay.
So that can be, to the extent it is something you're using to identify a product, then that would be a trademark. But an illustration is a drawing, and a drawing is a copyright.
Okay. So with the poems describing the illustration, both poem and illustration would be under the same copyright?
Sure. You can file them together. Save yourself some money.
Okay. Thank you.
One more question.
I'm just trying to understand a little bit of the nuance. If you're doing like factual material and you're describing something and you get to a certain point where you feel another author has done a better job or you don't want to get in that far and you reference that author, I'll direct
you. Your mistake, this one's easy. I'm going to cut you off because I think that we have one person who's waiting, so we're going to do one more.
Sure.
This is really quick. The answer is there's a huge distinction between plagiarism and infringement. Plagiarism is using someone's work without citation, and you get in trouble in the academic field for that, for claiming their work is your own, you're lying about what you've done, you're a bad scholar, tis tis, no tenure for you. Infringing is using their copyrighted work without permission, and then you've broken the law. Just because you reference something and you cite it gets you out of trouble with the scholarship committee, does not get you out of trouble with the copyright, unless you have permission to use it. So citation is good for scholarship, doesn't get you off the hook for infringement, still get permission. She had been waiting, so let's do... I'm sorry.
I just had a question.
You run this, Keith. You're better.
If you're doing a collaboration with someone, like if you're writing something or whatever, and as far as copywriting with that, how does that work?
If you are collaborating with someone and you have the intention to make it a joint work that both of you are working on, you'll be deemed joint authors. It's best to have an agreement between you as to how things will be done. And just write it down in English. It doesn't have to be done by a lawyer, but write down who gets what, who's allowed to do what. Assume that in a year you'll be hating each other, and you need to make sure that anything you want to do is protected by that contract. And write it in English. Don't try to sound like a lawyer, because you can't. But the joint work will be covered as a joint work. You're both authors. There are certain legal defaults, but whatever you agree between you will be what covers it. So agree to exactly what you want. Write it down. Sign it. Date it. In a perfect world, get it notarized. It doesn't have to be. But to have the signed agreement as to your rights against each other, and the term of the copyright extends from the death of the last die of the authors.
Mine is quick. If you get music for dance performance that then you're going to charge people to come and attend, how do you go about getting permission for that?
You get a license to play the music through ASCAP or BMI.
Thank you.
Back to the 90 days thing. After 90 days, do you still have the implied copyrights?
It's not an implied copyright. If you have fixed your work in a tangible medium, you have copyright. The 90-day thing is more of a trial thing, and it's only going to really come into effect if you're trying to enforce it at court. It's a litigator thing. But best practice is, before you start publishing it anywhere, file it. It gives you greater rights. It gives you a stronger protection, potentially, if you take things to trial. So again, the best practice is, before you start distributing it, file it. It's not hard. Just always do it that way. Then you don't have to worry about the finesse little rules and the deadlines. If you're pushing up against the deadline, you're going to get in trouble. So publish it after you protect it.
If you're still in the middle of writing it, can you copyright it?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, this is our last one. I'll be outside for a few minutes if anyone needs to talk to me.
Is this recording going to be available anywhere?
Yes.
I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll be online at the EFF website.
EFF.dragoncon.org.
It'll take us, about a month to get them all edited and put up there, but they will be up there.
Okay, we got to clear out. Someone else has to.